Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly podcast in which the editors of a magazine that advocates for reducing the size and scope of government gather each week to count their L's. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Happy post-solstice, comrades.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
We are going to talk about the potential for rolling back some of America's post-9/11 policies. But first, are you finding it harder than ever to keep up with the news? Frustrated with paywalls? Irritated by non-paywalled clickbait and pop-up ads? Well, imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the most reliable news sites. An app that filters out fake news, yet still presents every story from multiple perspectives in order to counteract confirmation bias. An app that highlights actual good news, like positive stories and everything, so you don't become despondent. Where journalists scour through news from around the world to find stories you wouldn't normally see. All of this is what an innovative Australian startup called Inkle, I-N-K-L, has come up with. Inkle.com has signed partnerships with more than 100 news sources, such as The Economist, The Atlantic, Bloomberg, and created a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best of news feed. For just $100 a year, this service gives you access to premium news that would otherwise cost you $12,000. If you go right now to inkle.com/podcast, they'll give you an additional 25% discount so you can get a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. That's inkle.com/podcast. Try it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. Last Thursday, with the explicit blessing of the Biden administration, the House of Representatives voted 268-161 to repeal the 2002 authorization for the use of military force, which had provided the legal justification for the disastrous Iraq war. The Senate is expected to vote to pass the repeal sometime this year, perhaps folding in a rollback of the 1991 Iraq war authorization as well. This, to my ear, sounds like kind of surprisingly good news, even though Joe Biden did campaign on this, but usually presidents do not act as dovish as they present on the campaign trail. KMW, otherwise known as Catherine Mangue Ward, our headline on this from the estimable Fiona Harrigan was, quote, repealing the 2002 AUMF, won't be enough to end forever wars. Can you explain why that is the case?
Fiona has only worked for Reason for a short time, but she has historically been correct, and she is correct about this. So Congress hasn't declared war, I don't think, since World War II. And yet we've been in a lot of wars, and those wars have mostly not been great. They've been dumb or badly conducted or both. I think 41 operations in 19 countries. That is thanks to generous interpretations of the 2001 AUMF. They're everywhere. So the trouble is that we have now rolled back the specific authorization for a specific incursion into Iraq, but that AUMF has been used mostly as a secondary justification. Obama, I think, at one point said it was like the backup legal concept. There's a term of art that I can't remember now, but it's basically like, if you don't like this one, you could try this argument too. We love to give presidents lots of power to wage wars. This is because Congress sucks and doesn't want to do their job. But it's almost like if you give a mechanism that allows people to work around Congress, the most directly accountable body, that we get a government that does things that people don't necessarily want done. Now, would Congress do a good job if it resumed its full kind of authority over war making? No, they would still do dumb stuff. But I think they would do less dumb stuff, which is here and always my goal for politics.
On the other hand, the reason why presidents are working around Congress here is because Congress keeps giving them the authority to do so and keeps saying, hey, we don't want to do that. That's your business. We're like, let's just sign one thing and get it over with. And so we end up with a situation where Congress isn't just sort of losing its authority that it wants back.
It's giving it away.
Actively giving away its authority.
Right out the window.
Congress, for the most part, has not wanted to have that responsibility on their shoulders because they like getting elected.
Well, I mean, given that, Nick, you know, is it even worth...
If that is my real name.
Is it even worth, like, getting exercised about these legal niceties, this TVA-like paperwork, Nick, about this stuff when the executive branch can... I just want to get this. I want to get the grunts.
Are you flash-forwarding to Loki, the worst show currently on television?
No, we're going to fight Gillespie.
For the listeners who aren't aware of what the TVA is, it's the Time Variance Authority, which is currently a bureaucratic mechanism Disney Plus show Loki. Footnote over.
Footnote's never over.
If we're going to be footnoting cultural references, Suderman, with torturous Sudermanian explanations, holy crap. You don't want to...
I want to know...
The entire Super 70 sports timeline is going to be footnoted several times
when
a day.
When you reference Butch Dudasky next time, I want to know who that guy is and what he did.
Is that a real
Matt,
name?
Can we talk about Morgana, the kissing bandit, at this point? If we're going to just
and
in?
The John 3:16 guy, never forget.
Catherine
is right to point out that we haven't declared war since June 4th, 1942, when we declared war on Hungary, Bulgaria, and Romania. So obviously, I would like to reauthorize that war just in general. Yeah. But Nick,
that war I don't think ever ended, Matt, if we're being honest.
They're still finding people in bunkers in Albania. The question is it worth even kind of caring about this level of paperwork, given what Catherine and Peter said about the ease with which the executive branch already does whatever the hell it wants to?
Well, and I mean, when we're talking about war now, we're going back like 70 years. So, what I found heartening about this House of Representatives vote is about 18 months ago, the same thing came up. The vote then was 236 to 166, with 27 people not voting. This time around, it was 268 to 161. Only two idiots didn't vote. And more kind of hearteningly, the GOP voted, 49 people, members of the GOP voted to end the authorization as opposed to merely 11 18 months ago. So if, you know, we extrapolate out, you know, in another 20 to 50 years, a slim majority of Republicans will be against stupid wars that they claim to not want because they are the party of fiscal conservatism and restrained government. But it's good. You know, Congress is, they're always the last to get in on the party, but it's good to see them finally catching up to the American people.
Suderman, you've lamented on this podcast in the past the lack of the kind of Washington, D.C. Institutional foreign policy skepticism or, you know, interventionism light or et cetera. The Biden administration is nonetheless heading towards removing all combat troops from Afghanistan. This is not the AOMF under discussion. That was the Iraq one. But nonetheless, this is part of the conversation that's happening in the headlines all the time, partly because the Taliban is just gobbling up territory, driving out U.S.-backed Afghan government, people exercising the Susan Collinses of the world because Sharia law is around the corner. Do you think Washington has the stomach to absorb what is happening, what is going to happen probably inevitably in Afghanistan with the pullout of U.S. combat troops?
I think that's a good question. And honestly, I think it could go either way at this point. I think, you know, it's notable that the opposition to removing the AOMF, which again is not the same thing as pulling the troops out of Afghanistan, is coming from Senate Republican leadership, right? So you've got Mitch McConnell saying reality is more complicated, more dangerous, and less politically convenient than its supporters believe, right? The fact of the matter is the legal and practical application of the 2002 AOMF extends far beyond the defeat of Saddam Hussein's regime, right? And so there is still a faction and a contingent here that wants to keep the status quo alive when it comes to the permanent war footing of the United States. And the fact that this started, and this is mostly focused on the 2002 AUMF, I think is also telling. because it is the 2001 AUMF that is still most potent and is sort of the primary justification for things. And the Biden administration has said that, well, we're okay with getting rid of the 2002 one because, as Catherine said, it's kind of the backup justification. It's no longer the primary justification for any of the foreign wars we're doing, or, you know, the kind of quasi wars that we're doing right now. And so I sort of look at this, and on the one hand, I think this is good. This is progress in the right direction. It's nice to see that there are some Republicans on board, that this is bipartisan. And yet I also sort of feel like this is, in some sense, it's a little bit symbolic, right? It's sort of, we're going to do something that makes you feel like we've done something that's sort of rolling back the forever war. And it's also, I think, pretty clearly designed as a sort of partisan maneuver to rein in or restrain Republican action in the future. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, I wish that sort of theory would guide more partisan action. Hey, wait, we're in power now. Let's take away the powers that the other party might use in the future. And if Republicans did that for Democrats and Democrats did that for Republicans, that would probably be an okay state of affairs. At the same time here, I think there's some amount of cynical political calculation going into this, despite the fact that I generally support this.
Matt, there is probably maybe 5 to 10% of the American population, the American voting population, that can name a single city in Afghanistan. When we pull out of that country, we will go back to ignoring it as we did, except at those moments when it behooved us to point out that the Soviet Union had invaded it and was getting slaughtered there. There will be no backlash against anybody who says, yeah, we should pull out of Afghanistan.
Public, yeah.
And we've already moved on, but voting wise. And,
yeah, yeah.
You know, we've already moved on. Like, China is the next big thing. So we're going to be talking about that. We have, you know, we have different kind of, you know, Cold War manque to fight. So Afghanistan is gone. Iraq is gone. Nobody gives a shit about this stuff anymore. We didn't even really care about the Israel-Palestinian conflict, which is still kind of going on. We've got new fish to fry.
Catherine, referencing Peter's talk about the 2001, the 914 AUMF, which Eli Lake wrote a good piece about for us about a decade ago. Let me read to you from it and then do a John Stossel impersonation. Okay, here's from the 914. The president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th, 2001, or harbored such organizations or persons in order to prevent any future acts of international terrorism against the United States by such nations, organizations, or persons, unquote. What's wrong with that, Catherine? That sounds sensible.
That was a good Stossel impression. Yeah, those words in that moment seemed like a reasonable thing to say and do. I don't dispute that. What's happened, though, is that we have since then done this elaborate exercise in which we have systematically redefined almost every single word in there as maximally as possible. So we have turned the word terrorists into, you know, anyone who looked askance at the United States. We have turned the phrase nations, organizations, or persons, which have already quite expansive natural definitions.
Isn't that kind of all the people in all the different types of groups?
Well, I mean, those words mean something specific in foreign policy and in terms of, you know, how we understand what combat or use of force is legitimate globally. And I think that we have just sort of taken those words and made them as big as they possibly can be. And then we also did this thing where we started fighting about, you may be old enough to remember this, we started fighting about whether it was not an adequate response to people accused of being terrorists in some sense to use our criminal justice system to deal with them. You remember that fight when it was like, oh no, Obama is gonna give someone a trial? Like, no, we don't do that here in America because of, I don't know, I guess whatever is in the 2001 AUMF. And that That to me was an important turning point that I think was underappreciated at the time, that it was somehow perceived to be insufficiently serious about going after America's enemies to use other available legal techniques and sanctions to punish people who wished us harm and who tried to do us harm. And we just got super comfortable with the idea of grouping anything that the U.S. wanted to do abroad anywhere under the vague heading of terrorism, which it isn't. That simply isn't right. And the wording of the law was already vague, but we made it vaguer with our interpretation.
Peter, Nick was talking about, we've moved on. We have bigger fish to fry. There's also a domestic component to 9/11 and post 9/11 Patriot Act and all kinds of surveillance that went on. Besides, last Tuesday, the Biden administration came out with a big national security strategy about domestic extremism, which obviously called for more funding, because nothing will ever not get more funding in government for the rest of our lives. Called for screening federal employees in case they have ties to hate groups. It's affirmatively stated that the biggest threats these days are white supremacists and militia groups as top domestic security threats. How worried should we be, Peter, that we are, that there seems to be kind of a January 6th cranking up of the FBI machine to hunt down a domestic threat that may or may not be among us?
Well, obviously, January 6th was a worrying event, and so was the attack at Charlottesville. There are real issues here that are genuinely worrying and are not just completely made up. At the same time, as Catherine noted with the when she was talking about the 2001 AUMF, what happened was, well, there was an actual terrorist attack that demanded some sort of response. And so Congress put together an authorization to do some stuff that seemed reasonable at the time. And then over a period of years, the executive branch reinterpreted that authority in a way that was far more expansive than even the underlying expansive language would have necessarily suggested when it was originally passed. So every single time you see these sort of security measures, you see these big new programs and hunts for extremism and terrorism and, whatever it is that is being pitched as a way of protecting American security by going through a lot of records, doing a lot of surveillance, hiring a bunch of guys with guns to do a thing. Whenever that happens,
government, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. Whenever that happens, you can assume that even if there is something legitimate, at the base of it, right, that sort of started the process, that the program itself will end up being far more expansive and will probably somehow or another, in the end up being used to put people in jail because they sold drugs.
Yep. And I mean, I will
and
say
that's sort of the like, and I know it's like a little bit of a twist there, but like every single one of these programs in the end just gets like law enforcement is just like, well, we're not doing anything right now. We've got some authorization to do some stuff that we can kind of expand. Let's use that to go after some guys who are moving drugs around.
And I will say, like, it does look like, at least as of Friday, Biden is not explicitly pushing a domestic terrorism law, like a standalone domestic terrorism law, which is good. Like that has happened in other places after domestic terror attacks, and it has proven fatal to civil liberties, because our current deal, again, part of the 2001 AUMF, is that we think it's fine to hold suspected terrorists indefinitely without charging them. We think it's fine to try them via a military tribunal. We think it's fine to keep them imprisoned even if they're acquitted. We think it's fine to kill them in foreign countries where we are not even at war. And to pass a domestic terrorism law would be to bring us at least one step closer to treating American citizens in all those ways as well.
Nick, do you have any confidence that the same president who back in the 90s was, trying to push what became the Patriot Act and then bragged on it afterwards is going to be the one to create a safe haven for Edward Snowden and his new Substack in America?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so. You know, I have 110% confidence in that, Matt. I think Biden is, He's going to bring it all home.
You think President Kamala Harris in 2032 is going to close Guantanamo Bay?
2032? I'm figuring that's going to be like August or September. Yeah.
What if Substack is just an FBI plot? Yeah. It's a false flag operation, right?
And galaxy brain just... stuff right here, guys.
Yeah, they're going after the cocktail snacks, Peter. So yeah. Watch out.
You were saying.
But what we're all kind of fumbling around is that there's, you know, there are magic words that get written into law that then, you know, become a jumping off point for whatever the state is going to do or particular interests in the state are going to do. It's worth remembering that, you know, 9/11 was a weird moment where it was such a rupture that things actually got done ahead of time. But we'll find out at a certain point how far ahead of any kind of legal justification that the FBI and the CIA and the NSA have gotten. We'll find that out in 10 to 20 years, and it'll look a lot like the 70s and the 90s. And, you know, when Snowden, along with other people, came out with what was actually going on, despite having been told, no, this time we have really stopped all kinds of dragnet surveillance on American people. So, you know, we shouldn't get too lost in the weeds of legal declarations.
Let's shift gears to another issue that Reason has been right about for decades, which is what Jacob Sullum used to call back in the day, e-cigarettes, e-cigs. Otherwise now known as vaping. There's a bunch of news related to vaping over the past 10 days. First, there was a video that went viral from Ocean City, Maryland, which I don't know why we still allow Ocean City, Maryland, but that's another story, where cops tased a teen kid who was vaping and refusing to show his ID. Then came news last Wednesday, that the city council in Washington, D.C. voted to ban flavored e-cigarettes, menthol cigarettes, and flavored cigars. I love, we're going to ban flavored cigars. Y'all know that cigars have flavor, right? Oregon also just signed a state ban into law of selling any nicotine-having vapes online. And then last, and certainly not least, back, I forget exactly when, but in the early days of COVID, there was a lot of great scare media about how vaping is going to leave people more susceptible to COVID. Well, it turns out that there was a big study done on this by the Journal of Primary Care and Community Health, which was covered nowhere except by Reason and like Jacob Greer on Twitter, that showed that that was all BS all along. So, Catherine, when are we going to learn, or is there just too much structure for people or incentives for people to not learn?
We're never going to learn. Of course we're never going to learn. I mean, we have now gotten ourselves in a situation where very realistically a police could nab you for vaping and be like, hey, kid, what's in that cartridge? And if you're like, officer, it's only marijuana, they'll be like, carry on. Very good. As long as it's not freaking mint flavored nicotine juice. Like, what world did what? Like, this is a, like, what variant has done this to us? Like, and it will always be Eric
the
Garner's
Delta variant.
It will always be Eric Garner's all the way down. It's just, you know, looking at that video of that kid that got tased in Ocean City, like, he wasn't just tased. He was tased, jumped on by several officers, eventually hogtied and carried off down the boardwalk for vaping. And it will always be like that. There will always be someone with a knee on someone's back, on someone's neck. Every law you have to understand, and Billy Binion has written about this movingly for us recently, every law, you have to be willing to enforce it violently and sometimes to the point of death. And that is not a reasonable price to pay for vaping. And by the way, if this kid or his family were to sue for the treatment that he just received, guess what? Qualified immunity. So those officers do not stand to face consequences for their actions, which screws up everyone's incentives even worse.
Nick, is there something in the brain that allows people to not learn from prohibition? I'm thinking of the spectacular interview you did with Ken Burns. was it 10 years ago? He had
a long time ago now.
It was a prohibition documentary, just to reset for the kids, and go out and look for it in the archives. It comes out, a documentary about prohibition. This is like in 2010, 2011, something like that. And Nick is like, hey, is there a contemporary lesson that we can learn about the prohibition of alcohol? Like maybe some other things that we shouldn't prohibit because unintended consequences? And Ken Burns is like, yeah, totally. It means that the Tea Party is messed up.
You know, the book to go to for that is Last Call, Daniel Okrent's History of Prohibition, which was one of the main source texts for Ken Burns's generally interesting and fascinating Prohibition documentary series, which is available online. But Last Call explicitly talks about Prohibition in the context of the drug war. So I do think there are ways to turn. And, you know, like, for instance, I've been stewing lately, partly because I'm going to be flying soon again, but, you know, the TSA, which shouldn't exist, but does and will never, you know, be rescinded until there's a revolution and a new government takes over completely. They don't even care what you bring on. Like they, on the TSA website, they tell you they don't care what you're bringing through your individual luggage. They don't care about your cartridges, your vapes. You could have DMT. You could have, you know, grape Kool-Aid flavored tobacco. You could have whatever, and they're not going to stop. People are getting fed up with this. And the fact is that, you know, police are less likely probably to bust somebody in the chops because they're selling loose cigarettes or they're vaping. You know, we need to focus on every instance of this and drum it up and use it to push for criminal justice reform and restraint of police on stupid nuisance laws. But I think people are getting smarter. I do. I mean, I think we're restrained much less in our daily activities than we used to be. Matt, even you and I, remembering back to the, you know, the 19th century, even before the American League existed, you know, people were more constrained in what they could do while they were walking around on the streets. So we're learning not fast enough, but we're getting there.
It's true that anywhere you walk in the five boroughs of New York, presumably I don't walk a lot in Staten Island, you're just clouds of marijuana smoke these days. So yeah, we're learning. Fun fact about the TSA: last time I flew down to Miami, it was the first time that a TSA agent flipped through the pages of a book that I had online. They were stopping absolutely every single person in the conveyor belt and like, yeah, flipping through the book. But
what did you have? Like a bunch of hacksaw blades and stuff?
Surprisingly, this time, no. But it gave me ideas for next time. Peter, you follow the science. Is there any like, You do the work. By the way, that was don't get me started about Falcon and the Snowman or whatever that show was about doing the work at the end. It was terrible.
Your absolute resolute refusal to learn the name of that show is really delightful.
Yes. Peter, the talisman of like follow the science comes from the same people oftentimes who support this crap. Is that like what can we do to like very crudely colored maps? Like a color coding or something like that to get through to people that like just because kids are involved doesn't mean you have to abandon scientific inquiry.
Well, a lot of folks think that they're still following the science here because they view vaping as a gateway drug. Remember gateway drugs, guys? We've talked a lot about gateway drugs at Reason Magazine since like before I was born.
On my deathbed, I'm going to be like, I wish I'd done more gateway drugs.
Right. No, I mean, and so this is their argument. And I've heard this even from people who are pretty responsible and pretty smart in the kind of public health bureaucracy. They say, well, look, we have some evidence that candy flavored vaping leads to kids getting addicted eventually to worse tobacco products. And what they can't do is sort of weigh that to whatever extent that may be happening against the actual value of vaping for pulling people off of much worse cigarettes, right? And so there is a, like, just if we want to like completely ignore the libertarian, people should be free to put whatever they want in their bodies argument. And that is a very good argument that we shouldn't ignore. But if we wanted to do that because we were going to think like bureaucrats who just don't buy that argument at all, the right way to do this would be to say, well, look, if you think that these things are a problematic gateway drug, let's weigh that against the actual value in terms of harm reduction, because vaping is much less problematic for your health than smoking regular cigarettes. And what they won't do is that sort of weighing, in part because there are children involved. And whenever there are children involved, there are suburban moms and teachers and bureaucrats, and there's like a whole coalition of them. And it's just, it's an issue every single time. And politicians listen to those folks. And nobody can sort of make, can figure out how to kind of weigh those things in their head, much less actually just sort of say, hey, wait a minute. It's grape flavored vaping. Is that really something that we want cops beating up teenagers and hog tying them over? Defund the vape, please.
We're going to get to our just to note that my daughter's not yet a teenager, so I can't affirmatively say that we do want that, but soon she will be, and my views may change. Anyways, we're going to get to our email of the week here in a moment. But first, living in a digital age where your personal data is always under attack, online privacy might seem to be a thing of the past. Or not. Did you know that there's a better way to protect your information and privacy without worrying about the prying eyes of big tech mining and stealing your private data? Introducing Secure, encrypted instant messaging and secure email service hosted in Switzerland, where the world's strictest data privacy laws obtain. By using proprietary military-grade encryption methods, a proprietary platform, and servers hosted in Switzerland, Secure protects your data from the invasive Cloud Act and other various intrusive laws. Shield your email and instant messaging services from the data gobblers at Amazon Web Services, Facebook, WhatsApp, Microsoft, Google, other ones. Take back your privacy and security today with Secure by going to secure.com. That's S-E-K-U-R.com, because everybody has to have a special spelling today. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder to email your questions, queries to this podcast using the address roundtable@reason.com. Today's comes from Zach Kenyon, great name, who writes, "Hi, Roundtable. The Supreme Court ruled that the city of Philadelphia violated the Free Exercise Clause by refusing to contract with Catholic Social Services, CSS, based on their anti-same-sex couple policy. Although many libertarians would disagree with CSS's policy, it seems to me that this is a win for the Constitution and for private organization. As someone who supports the rights of businesses to provide goods and services to whomever they may or may not want to, I always come back to the Public Accommodations Clause of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, something that seemed quite necessary at the time. If a social services agency doesn't want to place adopted children with same-sex couples, or a cake baker doesn't want to make a cake for a same-sex wedding, how is that different from a hotel owner refusing a room to a black person? Or is there no difference? Is it possible to be in favor of the public accommodations law and be in favor of the recent Supreme Court rulings that sided with private organizations?" Signed, a conflicted libertarian. Catherine, I know that you always enjoy parsing the public accommodation clause on Monday mornings. What say you?
Thank you so much for coming to me first on this question, Matt. Yes. I really appreciate that so much. A lot. Thank you.
Yeah, Editor-in-chief.
This is a thing that causes many libertarians to be conflicted, Zach. I think that there are plenty of people who have written quite intelligently about this who are on the side of you can say, no, you don't have to bake the cake, and also say, yes, you have to rent a hotel room to a black person. And Virginia Postrell has written very interestingly and in a way that's very historically literate about this. Ron Bailey, I believe, is also Reason's own Ron Bailey is on the side of Public Accommodations Act was necessary and consistent with libertarian principles. I have much more mixed feelings. I think that if you value deep intellectual consistency, it is very, very hard to make the case that the CSS case was rightly decided, that the cake baker does not have to bake the cake, and also argue that the Public Accommodations Act, the Public Accommodations Clause is necessary and good. Those things, are not consistent with each other. As you very, very nicely put it in your question, at the time, there was such a deep dysfunction in our society, which I would argue, and which Reason has argued many times, was created by, nurtured by, sustained by the state. And that really some of the worst sins of segregation, of racism, were creatures of state action. But the public accommodation piece was broadly meant to address private prejudice, individual discriminatory action. And so in that sense, you know, I continue to wish our laws were rational and consistent across the board. They are not. On my list of libertarian things I am looking to abolish, I am not putting the 1964 Civil Rights Act anywhere near the top of that list. But I do like to see cases that hem in the extent of the public accommodations law. The place where it can and might grow is in growing the number of protected classes. It started out as a small number of protected classes, and that list grows every year. And so I like to see stuff like the CSS decision. Again, I strongly disagree with the principles of this Catholic adoption agency. I think it is ridiculous not to place babies with same-sex couples. Dear Lord, you morons. However, it is their right. And I try to make a habit of protecting people's rights to do things that I don't like.
Nick, you're more on the Postrel, I think you're also Richard Epstein yeah. side of the argument. Let me ask you to respond to this. This
is something Richard Epstein is kind of correct about.
let me ask you to respond to the following critique, which I'm reading more recently. Yeah. Richard Hania, I get his name wrong, but he's been writing pretty interestingly of late. Christopher Caldwell writing less interestingly of late. But people make the argument that this, the public accommodation clause in particular, was kind of a stalking horse for, you know, first affirmative action, but second, like you always treating sort of results based. If the result isn't is kind of measurably equal, then it is under possible jurisdiction for the federal government to come in and kind of twist the knobs. What is your response to that slippery slope argument? Which there has been some slopes that have slipped.
Yeah. You know, but it certainly didn't have to. And when we're talking about affirmative action, in this case, coming out of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, we're talking about specific quotas that were either hard or soft, but enforced by the government and things like the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Absolutely didn't have to follow from any of this. And I think it's really important to look at this stuff historically, because Jim Crow, which, you know, the final, you know, prop kicked out from Jim Crow was the 1964 Title II, the public accommodations part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Jim Crow was distinct from anything that we're dealing with now. You know, it can, could gay people get a cake from someplace else other than Masterpiece Cakes in Colorado? Yes. The situation in 1964 throughout large parts of the South was not quite that, even though de jure segregation had effectively been ended a decade before. And, you know, Jim Crow is, we're talking about centuries of institutionalized state, you know, state enhanced discrimination. So I think, you know, we need to look at these things through, you know, historical lenses as much as anything else. The other thing that I will say, though, and I agree with Catherine, you know, when you start to say, well, should a Jewish baker have to, you know, bake a gay Nazi wedding cake, you know, for a Palestinian, you know, in the shape of a missile raining down on Tel Aviv or something, you know, everybody knows no, like that doesn't make any sense. Having said that, you know, the Catholic Church, maybe if a church is using religion and theology in order to be massively discriminatory against any kind of social science, of course, against a growing public consensus, maybe they lose their tax-exempt status. Maybe we get rid of tax-exempt status for all organizations. You're either in society or you're not, and you're paying taxes. But to go back, and I say this as a lapsed Catholic, which is to say, you know, somebody who will become Catholic like John Wayne and Jean-Paul Sartre on my deathbed, I'll ask for last rites. But can we start talking about like religious people who use theology in order to be discriminatory? Let's call that out, you know, because, you know, people are like, oh, I'm not a bigot. It's just that I happen to subscribe to a theology which says gays are going to burn in hell. And against all empirical data, I'm going to suggest that gays will molest kids that they adopt. You know, let's call that out in the same way that libertarians did not call out de jure or de facto segregation in 1964. To everybody who looks back at Barry Goldwater and is like, oh, you know, he was really libertarian. He wasn't. In 1964, he was towards the end of his career. In 1964, he did everything to nod and wink to people who were segregationists who wanted to maintain de jure as well as de facto segregation for as long as possible. And that's a dark stain on a libertarian legacy.
Peter, Nick has opened enough can of worms
to start a worm factory, Matt, yeah, or a worm farm.
We can go fish.
Maybe just to catch a couple of fish.
To catch a couple of fish. You're from Florida, Peter. As Nick well knows by reading Jackie Robinson's marvelous Baseball Has Done It book, which came out in 1964.
Required reading
for the footnote.
Yes. You could not, as a black or Cuban player with any kind of dark skin, get hotel accommodation in spring training in Florida. You couldn't. You had to stay with families. Does that suggest perhaps first that, you know, you're a racist, but more importantly, that there is something measurable with businesses kind of cartelize their segregation that makes it different than a modern cake shop? Is there a legal standard that like maybe explains itself and allows everyone to maintain that sense of cognitive dissonance that makes Catherine
call it a market failure? From a libertarian, from an economistic libertarian point of view, there was a market failure in Florida if you're a black person and you couldn't stay in a hotel in 1964. Today in Colorado, is there a market failure in terms of cakes, in terms of other types of things? Maybe that's one of the things that goes into an analysis of whether or not state action to remedy a really kind of unendurable wrong is being committed.
Peter?
Well, I agree with Nick. There was a market failure, and there was also a cultural failure, and the two things are interrelated. Markets are very powerful, and market incentives are very powerful, but so are cultural incentives. And sometimes, I would say that is not always the case, but sometimes the law can be used to break through those cultural failures because they have reached some sort of a stasis point where some sort of forcing action is the only obvious way to get through it. I think that's very rare, though, you need to assume that there will be that it won't necessarily go exactly as planned, that there will be, in some cases, unintended consequences, but that's not always necessarily a case against doing it, you know? And in some cases, we have cultural failures within the law. I would say that right now, there are some pretty big, or within the legal apparatus anyway, there are some pretty big cultural failures within Congress, and it's not obvious, since Congress would have to make the laws to break them, how exactly those are going to get unbroken.
Let's go to a kind of lightning round before we get to our what we have been consuming, since we have a little bit of time in between those things. The New York City is having a mayoral election on Tuesday. It's also a ranked mayoral primary that is expected to determine the winner, since New York not only is a heavily Democratic town, but Curtis Sliwa is expected to win the Republican nomination, and chances are he won't have that much of a chance, let alone Libertarian who's running. But anyways, there's four main candidates at this point in a field of 8 or 10 who are polling consistently the double digits. They are Eric Adams, Andrew Yang, Catherine Garcia, and Maya Wiley. So we get a lot of, I get a lot of like, hey, who are you guys rooting for stuff here? So Nick, I presume you're not voting, not being a member of the Democratic Party. Do you have any rooting interest? And is there any import of this election outside of the five boroughs that the rest of the country should care about?
Yeah, the one thing that is, conceivably of interest beyond the people who vote for the Democratic, candidate who is going to end up being mayor, is that the idea of defunding the police in a liberal city such as New York has gotten surprisingly little traction out of the three out of the four people that you just mentioned are emphatically in favor of funding the police and actually increasing police presence against not just crime, but against things like, you know, obviously mentally ill people scaring the shit out of people on the subway. And that should be something that people should, you know, be thinking about, because there is this sense, if you live mostly on Twitter or other forms of social media, that nobody is really in favor of police anymore, that, you know, all cops are bastards, all of that kind of stuff. It simply isn't even true among Democrats in a liberal city like New York. So, you know, that's important. Even as I say, and I think we disagree on this, Matt, I think that the resurgence of crime in New York is mostly a political issue. That is, it's more like we're going back to 2019 crime levels rather than seeing, you know, the beginning of a new era of like Abe Beams New York. But having said that, I think, you know, it's important to understand police really need to be regulated better than they are. We need to get rid of things like qualified immunity. We need to rein in police unions that allow cops to act with impunity, you know, whether we're talking about vaping teenagers or, you know, all sorts of people, all in all sorts of circumstances. Having said that, people generally recognize the function and the, you know, the efficacy of having, you know, meaningful police presence to in order to kind of keep crime at bay.
I should hastily point out that, and you can see this in the Reason archives, the New York NYPD police union is really one of the worst, and they have responded to any possible lessening of their power with blaming all the crimes on that. Not much of that carries a lot of evidentiary weight. Catherine, do you have any interest in this race? Do you have any rooting interest? Do you think there's any lesson to be gleaned for the rest of our beautiful United States?
I have an abstract interest in ranked choice voting, but not an emotional one, which some people really do have a deep investment in that idea. New York, I think, was likely to somehow screw up the implementation of it because their election system is already totally whacked. And I just like to take a minute now and again to remind people that Yang is not a libertarian. Thank you. The end.
I can't believe anyone thinks he is. Suderman, what say you?
I don't know. I'm glad I don't live in New York.
You were singing the New York's praises on this podcast a week ago.
It's a great place to visit.
It's not as great to live as a local.
A related question is, like, does any major city in America have a mayor who is not a complete disaster?
What does that mayor tell us?
But he's still like trying to do like a weird cronyist.
Yeah, he's like a big and spend bullshit artist. You know, he's not good. And he might be the best of the
bunch. It's amazing to see and this is more on a state level, but it's expressed also in the local level, how many states, is now 30 out of 50, have the same party control the governorship, the legislature, both branches of it, and vote in this one particular way on a national level. Like, we are sorting, as expressed by our two-party politics, we are sorting in much higher numbers than we did before. And so that leads a lot of kind of one-party states, the biggest cities within them, to be even more like that. I think especially in Democratic places, since they tend to have bigger cities that are more Democratic. And that, generally speaking, has not been so bueno for the old governance. Political competition. It's good. Introduce it. All right. Let's go to our what you have been consuming in the cultural sphere. Peter Suderman, why don't you lead us off?
I have been reading A Desolation Called Peace, the novel by Arkady Martin. It is her second novel, the sequel to A Memory Called Empire, which I also recommended. It's a great, big, grand sci-fi space opera kind of first contact tale about understanding the understandable. If you like classic, big, sprawling space opera, this is a great book.
Nick, besides watching and loving Loki, what can you recommend?
God, that's the worst show. but I'll let you guys praise it in a couple.
We praised it last week, so you can.
We did.
Is it going to be praised again, or are we just going to have to go through the technical manual?
We do want to hear you snort a little bit more, but go on.
Contrarianism is a terminal disease, Nick. Man, just let people enjoy popular stuff.
It's a progressive
stuff.
Disease. No,
contrarianism is not a disease.
How do we know that Loki is popular? I mean, Disney Plus shows are probably, there are dozens of viewers of most of them. But
the show has done so well that they are now moving all of their original programming to debuting on Wednesdays, Loki style, rather than debuting on Fridays, because Loki has defined Wednesday as the Disney day in the way that like HBO has owned Sunday nights for years. And so that's how you can tell that the show's actually doing quite well, is they're making other programming decisions except
for the fact that HBO actually like won primetime slots going back 20 years with The Sopranos. Whereas we don't really know how many people ever watch anything on any of these streaming services, because the fact is that probably very few people do. And that's a good thing, right? Niche penetration, niche markets are wonderful, but that's like mistaking Twitter for reality. It's like 2% of the American population.
Twitter isn't real life, but the MCU is.
Or, you know what? Yeah, but Disney is for sure. No, I get that. So I want to put a plug in for Free Speech and Why It Matters by Andrew Doyle. He's the British Irishman living in London. He's best known probably for being the creator of Titania McGrath. And I interviewed him a couple weeks ago for the Reason podcast. There's a video of it. He's also the host of a new show called GB News. And Free Speech and Why It Matters is a great new set of arguments about what the title says, why free speech is a good thing, free expression, and why it's particularly he's trying to appeal to younger generations, people under the age of 40 who are much more skeptical of untrammeled expression, especially when it conflicts with their sense of being outraged that anybody might be uncomfortable with, people speaking their truth.
I'm sure that is a lovely book. I just want to say that my support for free speech unfortunately comes against the border of any book title that has Why It Matters in the headline or subline.
This is in a lifetime of wrong takes, Matt. This is your wrongest take. The only thing that is better, the Why It Matters subheader head is good, but really the How X Made the Modern World genre, that's the best.
I like the case for. I'm a case for Why It Matters.
I'm a big fan of the curious case or a strange case of free speech.
You just want to get perplex in the at the end of it.
Yeah.
Well, the perplex.
The free speech perplex.
The free speech perplex. No, but it's got to be something. It's got to be
I'll settle for a verses headline. I'll take just a simple verses, but really X and Why It Matters or How X Made the Modern World.
Yeah. The other we'll thing that's great every is time. The cover of this book doesn't have justice, wrestling with free speech or something on the cover, or Uncle Sam having strangling a bald eagle or anything, partly because it's British, but it's just it's a text cover. And I think we need to get back to, the French are still holding to this. All books should just have text covers. Let's get rid of illustrations.
Okay.
All nonfiction books
except for Frank Frazetta and Boris
photos
covers.
Of the U.S. Capitol or possibly the Supreme Court. Stock photos of a big old building. Ideal cover for any book.
Poker playing dogs, are infinitely manipulable as well.
Catherine, lead us out of this morass. What have you been consuming?
Speaking of stuff that made the modern world, I started listening to a podcast that's been around for a while called Ologies with Ali Ward, no relation. And it's where she talks to an ologist each episode, a different kind of ologist. So paleontology, virology, neurobiology.
Cosmetology?
Probably. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of episodes. I haven't listened to enough of them yet. She's funny. It's fun. She apparently, I looked up her bio just before this podcast and learned that she's also a consulting producer on Netflix's Ada Twist Scientist, a series of books that I recommend to anyone who has young children. Iggy Peck, architect, Rosie Revere, engineer. Very good, like PC without being excruciating children's books. But if you, like me, do not, in fact, enjoy podcasts where, say, a group of four people just kind of shoot the shit and instead want a more produced podcast where you learn something, I recommend
Did you get through shade on fragging the tents over here.
I'm glad we recommended eliminating a nonprofit status and not listening to podcasts.
This podcast
we all agree with that, though, right?
This podcast is basically suicidal. Like, that's the subtext of this week's episode.
But nobody should be tax exempt, right?
Everybody should be tax exempt, Nick.
There you go.
Or nobody.
If nobody is, everyone is. No, wait.
That's not actually how it works.
Be Spartacus of taxation.
I have been consuming something. I'm going to confess my boomer style ignorance here. I have no idea who Bo Burnham is.
Oh, God.
This is what I recommended 2 weeks ago.
What
jerk.
The fuck?
Did you? I wasn't. Yes. I totally wasn't listening.
Yeah. Obviously.
This is when I check out.
I hate you all.
Well, can we talk about it a little bit then? Since this is a rerun, it's like Catherine, you liked it, but do you take his critique of late capitalism?
No,
is he
his
being
critique
ironic,
of what,
or is he being serious?
He's being totally serious, but he's also a comedian who's kind of mentally ill. So I'm not looking to him for a critique of the political system.
The others,
I'm looking to him for an incredibly powerful work of art and some catchy tunes.
He was really good in Promising Young Woman.
I am only vouching for two of the catchy tunes, but they're two of my favorite songs of the year, which is just simply The White Woman's Instagram, which sounds like it should be terrible.
That's the low point, Matt. That's the low point. Talk about punching down. And it's like, oh, let's make fun of white women in 2021. What a bold stance.
We're not in 2021. We're not down, bro. That's punching up now.
Okay. If one allows one to finish one's thought would be, despite the title and subject matter of said song and the direction of the punching, it's still a really very good song. I don't like this genre of music. I have a really high threshold for kind of novelty music that's not made by Weird Al Yankovic or Barnes & Barnes. And nonetheless, I found that song and also That Funny Feeling, which is about the world expiring in 7 years, to be just shockingly good pieces of music. And that's it. It's fun to be exposed to art with which I do not agree, but fine to be fetching. And that is the case. So I haven't seen the actual inside the special that it's based on or anything else like that. But I really like those two songs. And I wanted to say that in a public forum every week. That's all the public forology that we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable. Check out Nick's podcast called I'm Scoffing to Myself. That's on Wednesdays, reason.com/podcast. No, it's the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. He's got a bunch of stuff coming out of the Bitcoin conference down in Miami and elsewhere. And obviously the Soho Forum is producing and ratcheting up really great content as well, including an upcoming debate, which I can't believe, between Scott Horton and Bill Kristol. That's going to be some kind of thing. Stay tuned for that and check it out.
Shock and awe, Matt Welch. Shock and awe.
Awk and shaw, as they say. Thanks. See you next week.